Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain. Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org.
The workhorse cells that make up the beating heart can now be made cheaply and abundantly in the laboratory. Writing on May 28, 2012, in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a team of Wisconsin scientists describes a way to transform human stem cells, both embryonic and induced pluripotent stem cells, into the critical heart muscle cells by simple manipulation of one key developmental pathway. The technique promises a uniform, inexpensive, and far more efficient alternative to the complex bath of serum or growth factors now used to nudge blank slate stem cells to become specialized heart cells. That UW press release from 2012 indicates a bright future for sufferers of some heart conditions. How will this breakthrough affect medicine in general? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What role is the UW playing in stem cell research? Will new stem cell technology reduce the number of organ transplants? And has new technology put an end to the stem cell controversy? Our guest is Timothy Camp, professor of medicine and co-director of the Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine Center at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you very much.
UW-Madison certainly has played a key role with stem cells, going back with Jamie Thompson's work and so on. Before we get into some of the discoveries, some of the exciting clinical trials and worldwide developments with stem cells, let's back it up and get a good definition. What is a stem cell?
Stem cells are interesting cells in that they're master cells that can reproduce themselves, in other words, self-renew in culture. So they keep proliferating, growing, making new stem cells that are just like the other stem cells and can do that indefinitely in a tissue culture environment and in certain areas of the body called stem cell niches. And then what also makes these cells different is then they can undergo a process to form very specialized cells like heart cells, neurons, in a process we call differentiation. And so they can develop into these specialized cells when the body or the cell culture environment, when we grow them in the laboratory, tell them to make the specialized cells.
And where do we find the stem cells in our own bodies? And do all animals have stem cells? Do even plants have stem cells?
Yes, stem cells are pretty diffuse throughout biology. Plants and animals have them. Stem cells come in many different shapes and sizes as far as where they originate from. There are human embryonic stem cells that are derived from surplus embryos made for infertility treatment. These are taken by donation, scientifically approved donation, to make the embryonic stem cells from these leftover materials. And they are powerful cells in that they can form all cell types in the human body, and these were initially described by Jamie Thompson here at the University of Wisconsin. There are other cells that we call tissue-specific stem cells that are present in various tissues in the body that have a more limited repertoire of cells that they can form. For example, a stem cell in the heart can primarily form cells found in the heart, like heart muscle cells, like the blood vessel cells, whereas a stem cell found in the brain forms primarily brain cells, the nerves, the glia, the supporting cells, and so forth. So there are tissue-specific stem cells as well as the sort of master embryonic stem cells.
So the two differences you point out, I mean, one or two aspects of these stem cells. One is that they can generate more cells, but I mean, pretty much any cell can do that, right? Replicate itself.
That's not exactly true. Very few cell types can actually divide indefinitely in culture. They undergo a process called senescence, which is also similar to aging. And it means that if you take certain cells, you may be able to grow them, and they may divide a couple times in culture, and then they'll stop dividing. Or certain cells, like the vast majority of the cells in your heart or your brain, the nerve cells and the heart cells, are what we call terminally differentiated. They won't divide anymore. You can get a living cell out of a brain or a heart, but you put them in culture and they don't divide at all.
And what's the difference then? Are the cultures just not sophisticated enough to reproduce the environment in the human body?
Well, in the human body, most of the cells that you're born with in your heart haven't divided much at all after birth. And so the majority of your cells, according to some studies, 50% of the cells in your heart at the age of roughly 50, to keep the numbers simple, are still the heart cells you were born with, and they haven't divided at all. So many tissues in the body, the heart and brain are big examples, don't continuously divide at a high pace. Other tissues like the blood, where the cells turn over regularly, your red blood cells and your platelets and so forth, those cells are continually turning over, but some tissues don't. So,
Do we have a sense of why that is, and what's the advantage to having these incredibly long-lived cells in some organs?
That's a good question. I think for certain situations like the blood, where the cells undergo a lot of wear and tear and ultimately are degraded, or infection causes you to want more of the infection-fighting white blood cells, you can see where the body might want to turn over those cells because they're sort of destroyed in the process. Whereas other tissues, it's more difficult to work in new beating heart cells in a beating heart muscle. Or if you have brain cells that are integrated into very precise circuits or that go the whole length of your spinal cord to control a muscle, pretty hard to replace those by the body. So those may be cells that have a longer life. And it depends very much on the function and the individual tissue to understand that. But I think it's safe to say that we have a very incomplete understanding of that question at this point in time.
What about the umbilical cord? That's often mentioned in conjunction with stem cell work.
So that's another tissue that has stem cells in it. The interesting thing about the umbilical cord is it's sort of a younger tissue, and so it has stem cells primarily that are isolated from the blood in the umbilical cord. So the umbilical cord obviously comes along with the rich vascular supply, and you can get that blood out, which has fetal cells that are very early in their development and are easier to grow and form stem cells. For example, mesenchymal stem cells and other blood stem cells are obtained from the umbilical cord, including the hematopoietic stem cells or blood stem cells.
So let's compare sort of the then and the now, the then being maybe how far back does actually stem cell research, stem cell use go?
Well, stem cells really got their first recognition based on work in the blood system. And actually, it's one of those paradoxes of what's happened in our modern world. And a lot of some of the initial understanding came from Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the atomic bomb and what it did to people with their radiation exposure. And it impacted, in many cases, their bone marrow, where the blood stem cells live, and caused problems with these people who were exposed to the high-dose radiation to reform and develop new blood cells, oftentimes with higher doses in a lethal way. So that sort of planted the idea that there must be some source of cells to renew the blood in your body. And ultimately, over the next decade, the concept of blood stem cells came along, and people were able to isolate to some extent those blood cells in the bone marrow inside of your bones that continually renew your blood. And ultimately, the first bone marrow transplant where they took those blood cells was done between twins in the late 1950s. And ultimately, the concept of stem cells in other tissues came along, as well as other therapeutic approaches too.
What about the relationship between stem cells and the concept of cloning?
So cloning is an idea that has developed likewise over many years. And the Nobel Prize last year actually went to one of the pioneers in that area, John Gurdon, who was able to successfully take a nucleus, the part of a cell that contains the DNA, out of an intestinal cell in a frog, developing frog, a tadpole, and put it into a frog egg cell. It was just the female egg cell, taking out the native nucleus and putting in this adult nucleus, and could reprogram that egg cell into a new tadpole that was identical to the one that started. And so that was sort of the start of what's called somatic cell nuclear transfer, or cloning. And that was done in frogs, you know, now more than 50 years ago. But ultimately, science got to the point where it was able to be done in other organisms, in the mouse, and the big news in the mid-1990s was Dolly the sheep, when somatic cell nuclear transfer, or cloning, created an identical sheep by taking a mammary epithelial, a breast skin cell, and taking that nucleus out and putting it into a sheep egg and forming an identical copy of the sheep. And now in this past year, in May of this year, a prominent publication came out that showed that somatic cell nuclear transfer could be accomplished with human eggs, human oocytes donated by women, and a fibroblast, sort of a connective tissue cell, could have its nucleus removed, put in that human egg cell, and it would form embryonic stem cells. The beginning steps, it would actually form a small embryo, and they would isolate the embryonic stem cells, just like was done originally in in vitro fertilization embryos.
What became of Dolly? How successful was that experiment?
Well, Dolly was a proof-of-principle experiment that you could accomplish this cloning in large mammals, closer to humans. Obviously, a sheep is much more similar to a human being than a frog. So the question was, could that technique really be done in larger animals and in people? And so Dolly was a step forward. Dolly actually is no longer living, and it had some abnormalities. It wasn't a perfectly healthy sheep, although it lived, I believe, for 6 or 7 years, and then it developed a common disease that sheep in captivity get and was euthanized. So it showed that there could be what we call living, viable outcome from this procedure. And, you know, there are concerns that this procedure in mice and in other animals does bring along some potential problems that could cause health problems in these animals.
Is it related at all to the immune system and the lack of genetic diversification?
You know, the immune system hasn't been thought to be the main bad actor in that. It's more in the way that the cell's genes and genetic code can respond in development, because they didn't go through sort of the normal process of forming a sperm and egg and coming together. So what we call the epigenetics, sort of the things regulating how the genes turn on and off in different tissues, may be a little less than perfect. So that's sort of the current thinking as to why that might not work as well.
And there's always been controversy. Every time you bring stem cells into the conversation, it becomes a political issue, ethical debate, and so on. Can you say something about that and the effect that has on the ability of scientists to do the kind of research they might do?
Well, I would affirm that there are many important discussions along this area. I think all the scientists that I work with are concerned about these ethical issues too, and take pains to make sure that the research we do conforms to the highest standards. There are review committees now present in all the major universities that do this sort of stem cell research. Here we call it the SCRO Committee, Stem Cell Research Oversight Committee, that anyone working with these human embryonic stem cells and related cells has to have their protocols approved by this review committee to make sure it meets the ethical standards that have been outlined in a number of different places, such as what we call the National Academy of Sciences in this country has produced extensive guidelines to help lead the scientists. And sort of the gist is it that these cells have to be obtained in a way that there's informed consent, so people have to donate them freely without inducement, and it shouldn't influence their healthcare decisions. This should be a gift for research, and the cells have to be used appropriately. They shouldn't be used in ways that would potentially create things that no one wants. For example, cloning human beings is not something that the scientific community is after. The concepts about cloning are what are called therapeutic cloning. And so what scientists hope to be able to do is by doing that, what we call somatic cell nuclear transfer, taking one of your skin cells, taking the DNA, the nucleus out, and putting it into an egg to create cells that are genetically matched to you that then, for example, could be used to form new heart cells, new brain cells, new muscle cells. That is the concept of therapeutic cloning, and that's why many investigators and researchers are chasing down the concept of therapeutic cloning, not reproductive cloning. And so the oversight committees and the scientific community as a whole is very committed to doing this in the most ethically acceptable fashion. But anytime you're dealing with these issues, they're important issues and there are important debates and things that touch on issues that we've been discussing since the beginning of time. You know, what is the definition of life and those things, not things that we're all going to agree on and easy to get a single solution.
Are the main points of the controversy having to do with the fact or the suggestion that the embryo is a potential individual in all of these cases where we're talking about stem cells and embryos?
Well, I think it's safe to say that the embryos have the potential to become normal human beings if they're created in infertility clinics. After all, that's the purpose of that. Patients who can't have children through normal means have the embryos formed in a dish that are then transplanted to the mother so she can undergo a pregnancy. So they have the potential to become human beings. Although at the stage that they are at presently, there are no specialized cell types in them. They're all sort of blank slate stem cells, so to speak. So there's no neurons, no brain, no heart. And so, you know, that's where the challenge is. Is that entity the same as you and I talking here? And people have different opinions
on that.
It's
part of that whole continuum of at what point do you consider that an individual with a potential life.
Yes.
But you're saying those embryos would not be – they would just be discarded otherwise.
So research in this country that has used and generated embryonic stem cells has always used surplus. So in other words, when you undergo infertility treatment, you combine eggs and sperm in a dish. You don't know exactly how many will interact and how many little embryos will form. You don't want to transplant too many into the mother because multiple births can be problematic. And so oftentimes you have embryos that aren't used for that initial fertility treatment. They can be cryopreserved, in other words, frozen and used later by that same couple. Or if that couple doesn't want to use them, they can be used for research.
Just as a sidebar in that procedure, how is it decided which embryo to use?
Well, you're touching on another interesting issue. Typically, the specialist in this area can look at the embryos and understand to some extent which ones are developing more robustly and look more normal. So obviously, they'll choose the normal-looking embryos, and that's typically the way it's done. So there's a large randomness. Technologies now are advancing that investigators at some clinics can now take a single cell out of one of those developing embryos and do genetic testing. And so they can test, for example, to see if a disease gene is present in that embryo. So if a family has a history of Tay-Sachs disease or other genetically inherited diseases, it is now possible in some instances to test that developing embryo, see if it carries that bad gene, and choose not to select that. It's also possible to select for gender using that same technology. Obviously, that is another area that is ethically challenging area that there's a great deal of discussion
about. And are there issues, similar issues with cloning, even successful cloning?
Can you explain what you mean by that a little bit
more? Well, in terms of, creating an individual like a dolly, was that a controversial feat?
Sure. So that gets back to the question or the discrimination of the cloning process with the human cells. What is your purpose there, and what are you trying to do? So the scientific community as a whole has been trying to accomplish this for the process of a therapeutic cloning. So you have cells genetically matched to you that you can get new heart cells and so forth. But cloning theoretically in this way could also develop those embryos that could be transplanted, and you could clone, do what's called reproductive cloning, theoretically. Although no one knows if that's possible. We don't know if these embryos are good enough, but theoretically that's possible. And obviously human cloning raises all sorts of questions and is looked at as ethically not permissible by the majority of scientists and bioethicists. But the reality is, you know, I think it's probably oversimplified to think that we can exactly replicate, you know, an individual in every detail, because the developmental process, the environment is clearly going to impact. So it's science fiction now, and I think there will continue to be a great deal of debate along these lines.
If I followed you right, those stem cells that do come from the embryos, the ones that are not being used by couples that are going through fertility treatments, those are perhaps the most useful of all because they're undifferentiated. They can become any kind of cell.
That's right. The excitement about the embryonic stem cells is that they're sort of the master stem cells. So they can become any cell type in the body, theoretically. And so they give you a source of cells that can form anything that you may need, whether it's cells to treat diabetes, the beta cells in the pancreas, whether it's heart cells, liver cells. Those cells theoretically can form all of those. And over the last decade and a half since we first had access to the human embryonic stem cells, we've gotten progressively better and better at forming the specialized cell types. And the introduction that Norman gave describing ways to make heart cells is an example of that. Now we can make buckets and buckets of heart cells, whereas when we initially started doing this work, you know, you would be excited if you saw a handful, you know, a couple of hundred contracting heart cells. Now we can make tens of millions without too much effort. Obviously, it still takes effort, but it's possible, and it wasn't in the past.
And we'll follow the repercussions of that increased ability when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Timothy Camp, who is updating us on stem cell technology. And I mentioned in the introduction, in quoting this media release, these pluripotent stem cells, how are they different from, what, generic or everyday stem cells?
So they're... Initially, we talked about embryonic stem cells, so those are derived from embryos, but since about 2006 and for the human system 2007, we've had another source of what we call pluripotent stem cells, and these are called induced pluripotent stem cells. That word pluripotent is sort of the same as saying master stem cell. It can form all the cell types present in the body. So these induced pluripotent stem cells, Shinya Yamanaka, a researcher in Japan, and Jamie Thompson here at the University of Wisconsin, successfully reprogrammed somatic cells, so skin cells, and more recently blood cells and other cells, to take them back in time so they could become like these embryonic stem cells. So it's, I think, incredible that you can take a little piece of your skin, any of us here, and you can grow that in a dish, and then we can add genes that are expressed at high levels. So these are proteins that are expressed at high levels in embryonic stem cells, and we can convince those skin stem cells to go back in time and become like an embryonic stem cell. And the way that works, we're still trying to understand, but it's a process of reprogramming the cell. So it is a master stem cell, a pluripotent stem cell, what we call an induced pluripotent stem cell, or an iPS cell. The excitement about that is that it's not derived from embryos. So
takes
that
takes away that controversy.
That makes the controversies a little less. And also it's matched to the patient who donates it. So it's matched to you if you give the skin sample or to me. And if you need new cells in your body, the body recognizes foreign cells that come from other people, and that's one of our challenges with organ transplantation. We have to deal with immune rejection. So if we can get cells that are identical to yours genetically, there's a good chance the body's going to accept those when we make them into the brain cells or the
cells. So let's say I have that you want to work with my skin cells and you want to turn them into pluripotent cells, you know, in effect to, like, turn back their clock. What would you do with them? I mean, what would be a typical treatment that would involve use of those cells?
Well, a typical treatment is not here yet because these are new kids on the block. They were first discovered in the mouse in 2006 and 2007 in human. So they've only been around a little over 5 years. So treatment is not here yet. The concepts of treatment are the same as concepts of treatment with other stem cells. They may be used to form new heart muscle cells to treat patients after a heart attack if there's been a lot of heart damage. They may be used in degenerative conditions of the nervous system, like ALS, to grow new motor neurons, for example, that could help patients with that particular disease. So they could be used to form new blood cells. So, for example, a patient whose own blood stem cells were not working too well, for example, if they had leukemia, you might be able to reprogram these somatic cells, create new blood stem cells that you could then transplant in that would be genetically matched and would get around some of the challenges of bone marrow transplantation where you use donors that aren't perfect matches. So theoretically, there's a number of exciting applications where these could be used. I think the other area that is immediately accessible, that is making remarkable headway now, is that these cells can be used to understand human disease in ways that weren't previously possible. And that is now that we can take, for example, if unfortunately you have a genetic disease that impacts your heart or your brain or your liver due to a mutation in a single gene, we can take skin cells from you, and if it's a heart disease that causes you to have bad heart rhythms, like inherited arrhythmia syndrome, such as the long QT syndrome, which can cause bad heart rhythms that can be lethal unless you're treated with a defibrillator and other interventions. So now we can take your skin cells, we can turn them into these induced pluripotent stem cells, grow them up indefinitely in the lab so we can make more and more of these so we have an unlimited supply, and then we can turn them into heart cells. And now we have human heart cells in a dish that are beating, that are exactly like your human heart as far as the genes expressed and many of the properties of the muscle. And we can investigate what is wrong with these heart cells that they're causing these bad heart rhythms. And equally important, we can test new ways to treat the disease in a dish. So not subjecting patients to experimental treatments right away, but we can do our clinical trials in a dish, so to speak.
That's pretty amazing.
How fast would that be? Let's say if I have a heart problem and you're going to fix it with my, you know, stem cells.
That is a challenge. So if we are going to take your stem cells to fix it, it takes a while to do this reprogramming to get the induced pluripotent stem cells, and it takes a while to make them into heart cells. So with current technology, it'd be hard to do that in any time less than 2 or 3 months, and even that is pushing it. So that is a limitation. It's also the reason that some people are advocating, you should have your own stem cell bank.
What I was wondering as you started to describe
it. And how do these induced pluripotent stem cells compare to the embryonic stem cells in terms of their effectiveness? Are they equally good at doing what they need to do?
The jury's still out on that, and that applies to the newer somatic nuclear transfer embryonic stem cells, the clone stem cells. We don't know at this stage if any of those different cell types are absolutely better in certain aspects than others. Certainly, it's possible to get bad lines of each. So you can get embryonic stem cells that have developed problems. You can get induced pluripotent stem cells that are what we call incompletely reprogrammed. But if you've got good stem cell lines of any of those flavors, at least my interpretation of the existing data is they seem to behave fairly similarly and are giving similar readouts in experimental systems. We don't have data yet from clinical applications because those are just barely beginning to start.
And you said that these were the new kid on the block, the induced pluripotent ones. With the older embryonic stem cell clinical trials and things that have been done, what actually has been accomplished so far? I mean, there's been so much hype about the potential and all the diseases that could be helped. To date, what kind of accomplishments can you point to and say this would not have been possible without stem cells?
Well, I think the important thing to keep in mind is that stem cells are important tools to help us understand the human body and help us develop new concepts and new ways to approach human disease from basic research. So embryonic stem cells have pushed forward our understanding of stem cell biology and tissue-specific stem cells as we understand more of the signaling pathways and how to discriminate the different types of stem cells, how they may become dysfunctional. So there's been sort of a broad growth in our understanding of stem cells and of regenerative biology, helped along in part by the discovery of human embryonic stem cells. So that's part of the background. They're an important research tool that allows the biomedical researchers to advance our understandings, which ultimately leads to advances in our treatments. As far as clinical applications, it's taken a while to get the clinical applications because no one wants to do this unless it's safe. And so safety studies and understanding how the cells work in animal models are important initial steps, and all that takes time. So now the clinical trials are starting. There have been some stuttering in that. The first clinical trial with human embryonic stem cells was to treat spinal cord injury, and that was initiated by the Geron company and co-investigators, and they took the stem cells and made them into support cells for the spinal cord to help it repair itself when they transplanted those cells. Unfortunately, for a number of reasons that were related to the company and financing, that trial has been put on hold right now, and we hope it resumes so we can see. So far, there have not been any bad outcomes, but we don't know really the efficacy in that particular example. There are additional trials now initiated with embryonic stem cells, and a company called Advanced Cellular Technologies is working with eye diseases. Particularly, they and investigators here at UW have been successful in generating a cell type called a retinal pigment epithelial cell, and those RPE cells, is the abbreviation, are important to support the photoreceptors, the cells in your eyes that allow you to detect the different colors of light and to detect light. And if those support cells die, then the rest of the eye degenerates and it can cause blindness in a variety of ways. And so investigators are now treating select forms of visual diseases, blindness, with these RPEs in beginning clinical trials. For example, Charcot's dystrophy is being treated by that, as well as age-related macular degeneration. There are a couple of trials, including a trial we think that will be initiated soon with the induced pluripotent stem cells for age-related macular dystrophy.
And this would involve inserting cells into the eye?
Right. The eye is actually, for this sort of research application and therapy, is a pretty good place because you can really look through the eye and see where you're putting the cells, and it's a very restricted space, and so if there are problems, you can deal with it pretty directly. And so the eye turns out to be, for practical reasons, a useful testbed for some of these regenerative therapies. And starting out with more simple approaches, such as putting in support cells that can grow and fill in where they need to fill in, rather than trying to replace the actual photoreceptors, the cells that detect the light, which have complicated wiring. They have to connect back through the eye. This is probably a good starting point, and I think it will provide important proof of principle if it is successful. And there have been a few patients reported so far, and there's encouraging results thus far, but it is far too early to know how these will work out.
As far as the use of stem cells in these various procedures is concerned, how do you know, or do you really know, when you get the green light to do a procedure? I mean, if it's a drug, the FDA says, okay, it's cleared for use. But with a procedure, is it just a matter of you keep tinkering until it seems to be the way to go?
It's actually the FDA is involved in this country as well as and in other countries, similar regulatory agencies. The approval process is different for a drug, which is a small molecule, compared to what this is called, a biologic. So it's a cell is a particular form of that. So there are pathways that investigators and clinical trials have to go through to have their product approved. It's a work in progress because we haven't done this before. So for small molecules, for drugs, we've been working with these small molecules for, a half a century. And so the procedures to understand their safety, understand their efficacy are continuing to improve, but there's a pretty solid basis to base decisions by the Food and Drug Administration and careful studies that are done. For cellular therapies, we're still on the steep part of the learning curve. So they have to be approved, but it can be somewhat of a moving goal line to say, okay, you've done all the tests. And for example, the Geron clinical trial, which was the first one to use human embryonic stem cells in this country for a therapeutic application, at the end of the day had to submit more than 20,000 pages of research documentation that these cells pass the safety burden. So that's a pretty tall order.
No, that's a company. You also mentioned another company. I think it was Advanced Cell Technology, mm-hmm. which raises the question of the overlap between industry and science here, because if something could be developed that really worked, there's big money involved. What kind of protections are there in place right now so that you don't have the sort of money-making sale of material? How is that handled?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think if we go back and look at the small molecule or drug development, many of the concepts for drug development came out of basic research, academic research at universities. Some of those ideas were patented, and then ultimately the pharmaceutical industry became involved and developed them further, and did the safety testing in many cases, and developed the product that then became a drug that was used to treat a particular disease. It's actually that partnership of academics with industry that I think is essential to have a successful therapeutic application, because the reality is that academic researchers are not able to take all the steps needed to get a compound or a cell into therapeutic applications, and it takes a company typically to move forward to the last stages, really to get things in broad use and make them widely available for the public if it is an effective therapy. So there always is some partnership between the basic researchers, oftentimes at universities, and industry. Obviously, there are exceptions. Some things come out or develop specifically in industry. Sometimes things come out of research institutes that take it the whole way. But for the most part, this sort of basic academic research or industry partnership has been the common paradigm. And I think you'll see that in cell-based approaches too, that the ways to make the cells, to develop them may be done in academic settings, but really to get the broad-scale mass production of these products so you can go in and get a vial out of your freezer or order it FedEx to be there the next day are going to take the involvement of industry, because those are things that do make profit, but there's a reason that they make profit. They are good products for healthcare, and it's not easy to do the scale up and to make very safe, clean products. You don't want infections. You don't want to bring along bad cells that could cause tumors. So there's a lot of quality control that industry, I think, is uniquely available to do that isn't really typically done in research labs.
But I think we did say at the top that this new procedure of, in effect, creating these stem cells, these undifferentiated cells, can be done very inexpensively. And so it actually, I mean, it sounds as if it has the potential to be much more commercially or economically efficient than a lot of drug courses or organ transplants, for that matter.
Well, the price point for all these things is beyond me, and I think that will be something that we'll see. It's complicated, as you have observed, for drugs. You know, there are generic drugs that literally cost pennies per pill, and there are other treatments that cost, you know, literally several thousand dollars per dose, and so and everything in between. And the way those prices are determined are complex, depending on various other clinical approaches that are possible and competing products. So it's a complicated business. I think even though we can do it fairly inexpensively in the lab, some of these approaches to make the stem cells and to grow specific cell types, when you get it to a clinical-grade product, that's going to be more expensive because of the safety concerns. You know, if we have a cell culture that what we call gets contaminated and has bacteria in it, we throw it away. If you put something with bacteria into a patient, that's bad. And so you have to be much more careful, and again, the quality control is much more important. I think in the long term, there will be affordable ways to advance this. And, you know, people have criticized the heart stem cell approach for therapies because it, with current technology, it is very expensive to individually deliver cells to patients after a heart attack. It costs tens of thousands of dollars. But if you compare that to other things that in some cases we have to do, for example, heart transplantation. So if a patient is sick and has a weak heart, muscle so weak that it's not going to keep them alive.
That's pretty expensive,
too. They need a new heart. That turns out to be very expensive.
And you've got the problem of rejection of
right.
the organ.
So we'll spend about $500,000 typically in that range to do a heart transplant in a patient. Well, all of a sudden, some of the stem cell applications, if they can treat those same patients, are starting to look maybe they're not quite that
with guaranteed out of compatibility
range.
You mentioned that you're creating buckets and buckets of these heart stem cells now. These would be cells that could be put into someone to replace heart cells that have problems.
Well, the details of how we deliver the cells, how to get them into the heart safely, and how to repair the heart are very much a work in progress. So in the big picture, we can get a lot of cells that can be put into patients. But in the details, we're still trying to understand the best way to deliver those cells and really the best cell type to put in there. It may be that we don't want to put in a beating heart cell into an injured heart. We want to put in a cell that can become a beating heart cell so it can grow into the heart cell and repair the heart and sort of integrate in and over time. It may be that we just want to put in cells that tell the heart to repair itself, so secrete molecules that turn on the cells that are in the heart, the stem cells in the heart, that aren't quite doing what we'd like them to do, but send the signals to say, hey, pick it up and form new heart muscle because we need it. And so that is one thing we're trying to understand. What is the best cell type to put in? It's intuitive to think, well, if you want more beating heart muscle, you put beating heart cells in. In reality, it may not be that simple. There may be other cell types that may be helpful. The other issue is how to get them in there. Should we take a catheter and go through the blood vessels like we do a heart catheterization and inject them through the blood vessels? Should we do it surgically and open the chest and see, okay, there's where the heart attack is. Let's directly target the cells, inject them right in that area. It could be we need to use what are called tissue engineering approaches. So do we need to make a patch of heart tissue in a dish, in the laboratory, in a bioreactor that's a whole piece of heart muscle that's beating away that we can sort of sew into the heart and allow it to fix that area of heart that's damaged? You know, that gets into issues of blood supply. If you make a big patch, you've got to have a way for the blood to get there or it won't survive. And so there's some complex issues that the field is working through. So while I simply said we can make a lot of the heart cells, it that takes a little work before we can translate that into a new heart for you or me.
Without surgery, how would you get rid of the damaged tissue? Would it take care of itself somehow, or do you still need to find some way to remove that?
That's a good question. So the heart, chronically, after, for example, a heart attack, forms a scar where the beating heart tissue was that didn't get enough blood flow and died. The other approach that investigators are taking are saying, hey, wait a minute, let's try and get at this problem before it gets too bad and too chronic. And so you'll see there are some stem cell trials that are looking at patients who have had a big heart attack that didn't get their blood supplied in time, so that muscle is actively dying. The scar hasn't formed yet, and the heart is trying to repair, trying to remodel, but without intervention, it would scar. So if we can find that right window after a big heart attack in those patients to put in stem cells that will tell the heart, okay, let's repair in a more productive way, that's a way that sort of we can take advantage of the heart's own remodeling process to try and repair it. When the heart is old with regard to the scar and it's sort of a thin scarred area of muscle with fibrous tissue, it is theoretically more difficult to remodel that out. And you would hope that putting in the cells, the heart, like all tissue, is dynamic, that scar is always turning over, and that over time you could remodel it out. It may be in some circumstances you actually have to cut the scar out to help it and put a patch where that scar was of new heart tissue. And those are investigations that I think you'll see in the future.
We're going to have some final thoughts on stem cell breakthroughs when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Timothy Camp, and we are talking about stem cell research and some of the breakthroughs that might be on the horizon. I know that scientists like to stick with facts, but let me ask you to just speculate a little bit. If you imagine coming back as our guest in 10 years, if everything went the way you could imagine it going, what are some of the changes in medicine that we might be seeing?
Well, I think that gets to the whole concept of regenerative medicine. And regenerative medicine is not just about stem cells and using stem cells to generate or repair tissue. It's also about understanding how the body repairs itself, understanding the signaling molecules that tell the body to repair itself, understanding, for example, how if you cut the tip of a zebrafish heart off, unlike a person who would never form new heart tissue and would bleed to death, the zebrafish survives. It forms a clot at the end, and then it forms a completely new heart muscle at the end. And so why can the zebrafish do that, and why can't we? And so I think you're going to see we're going to learn more and more about understanding those differences and trying to harness that biology to help repair a human heart. So it's a little hard to predict which particular approaches are going to improve human health in the coming 10 years. I think you will see increasing number of trials at delivering cells to repair damaged tissues. Which cells are the most effective in the various diseases, I think we don't know yet. But I suspect there will be a handful of diseases, perhaps some of these visual diseases that we talked about earlier, that will show some benefit from cellular therapies. In the best world, some diseases such as diabetes, which are insulin-dependent diabetes, type 1 diabetes, juvenile onset, where there's a particular cell type that is destroyed, one might hope that we may learn ways to develop those cells that we could deliver them and also protect them from the disease process, that there is some hope that maybe a disease like that will be treatable. I think there will be sort of rare genetic diseases that we may find ways that with stem cells we can really help those diseases. But it's all a matter right now, I think, of continuing the research and continuing to learn and testing these various areas.
Is the ultimate for stem cell regeneration the brain?
The brain is obviously an important target. There are many neurodegenerative diseases where it's easy to think about replacing those neurons or support cells could be beneficial, multiple sclerosis, ALS, Parkinson's disease, and the list goes on. I think treating brain diseases will continue to advance, but that is one of the highest bars for treatment because, after all, our brains are complex. They have the nerve cells have connections that go in many different directions as long as your whole spinal cord in some cases. And so to get cells to recapitulate that by transplanting them is a tall order. I think there will be, again, some niche applications where we may see progress in the next 10 years. But treating some of the most common forms of neurodegenerative disease with stem cells, I think, is a long-term goal and one of the more challenging that we face.
What about cosmetic uses? If you have industry involved, I can picture things where it's, you know, okay, replace the cells that make you go bald or replace your skin with younger skin. We're always looking for that fountain of youth.
Well, I think there's no doubt that there are investigators looking at ways to use stem cells cosmetically to treat dermatologic diseases. It's not just, for applications that will help aged skin become young, but there are many dermatologic diseases that cause degenerative conditions impacting the skin that could be benefited. But also that technology could be used for cosmetic purposes. Certainly hair replacement, you can't tell by listening, but I've been paying attention to that personally. Some investigators have joked that that would be the biggest breakthrough of stem cell research, the first one to really show profit.
A lot of quick money there, yeah.
So I don't know. I'll be paying attention, though.
But it is interesting if you imagine cells that can kind of create new cells, then the potential seems unlimited in a science fiction kind of way. What are some of the other sort of, I guess, amazing ideas that people have come up with as possibilities?
Well, I'll give you another example that's really a breakthrough in the last 5 years, and that is something called direct reprogramming. And what that means is you can take one of these, for example, skin cells, and we've learned for several different cell types, you can put in a collection of genes. These are mainly genes that tell the DNA what to do, what we call transcription factors, and make them directly into heart cells or nerve cells or pancreatic beta cells. So this is called direct reprogramming. So we can now create those heart cells directly in a dish from the fibroblasts, for example. And so that's sort of amazing that you can just change the cell, not back to master stem cell.
Directly to something else.
But directly to something else. And what's even more amazing, and this is more recent discoveries, is you can do this in a living animal. So, for example, in a mouse who you've had induced a heart attack, so you've tied off a coronary artery, so part of the heart muscle dies. Investigators, Deepak Srivastava at UCSF, Gladstone, and Eric Olson is a leading investigator at UT Southwestern, have shown that you can do direct reprogramming in those hearts, where you can take that collection of genes and change the scar directly into beating heart muscle. And so that means you can deliver these and do the direct reprogramming in the tissue, and amazingly enough, they provide evidence that you can turn those fibroblast-like cells, the scar cells, into beating heart muscle and in part repair the injured heart. Now, whether that'll happen in larger animals, it's a mouse anomaly, whether it'll happen in people, we don't know yet, but that's pretty exciting discovery, this direct reprogramming. And again, it gets back to concepts of what controls a cell's identity. What is a cell? And we're learning more and more about how to tweak that.
So are you saying that it's possible that the whole stem cell technology might be just a step toward something else?
I think we continue to learn. Stem cells are an important tool. The whole concepts of regenerative medicine are broad, and there are many different ways to apply it, whether it's direct programming of cells, whether it's using stem cells, whether it's using signaling molecules or finding small molecules, drugs that can tweak stem cells, all those things may be involved. And it's an exciting time. I think there's a lot of promising research, but to get some of these treatments, it's also time-consuming.
Well, Timothy Camp, you've been very efficient with your time in explaining these things to us in a clear, succinct way. So thanks for that.
Thank you.
We'll have to have you back in 10 years or sooner and find out what's new. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland. Hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.